Good morning. I think it's a good time to start. I was given the great honor to introduce our speaker, Dr. Dinesh. I've known Dr. Dinesh for almost about 3 to 4 years. I should have met him 5 years ago when I first moved here. And he works right across the street and, essentially part of FAU. And I have a lot of patients with vertigo, and not only with oncology patients, but non-oncology patients. And I used to send it to some of the ENT folks. We have great faculty in the community, but they would always come back with just, you know, vestibular symptoms, really don't know what to do. And I can't remember how many times you feel lost with these cases. So not to send 50 cases to Dr. Dinesh every day, we probably could, all of us, but he's been a great resource. And plus, apart from that, just like all of us trained, he's a very a kind of like a science-based person, so he does quite a bit of research. Dr. Dinesh was just mentioning to me as a lab that he's going to roll out. Well, he's had a lab for a while, but he's going to roll out maybe a bigger and better lab. So it's always good for the residents, for the students, and all of us who trained in some of these academic places to work with doctors that are in our community who are not only clinicians, but actually clinician scientists as well. And Dr. Dinesh, I wasn't aware of some of his backdrop history, but UT Memphis is where he did his auditory electrophysiology fellowship, or his training per se. So I'll, without any ado, I'll have Dr. Dinesh come up. I just wanted to mention that the residents can fill out their evaluation forms. They'll be fantastic. Dr. Dinesh, thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me okay? That's a question as an audiologist we ask the first question. Can you hear me okay? And a lot of times people say, yeah, repeat it again. In any case, if you are here for this presentation, the correct title is Why We Should Not Say No to Our Patients. I have been in Boca for almost 21 years, and I started at FAU, and I have been able to have a good line of research on tinnitus and vertigo, so I'd like to share my findings and clinical practice outcomes with you. So we'll learn about a little bit about tinnitus. How many people actually have tinnitus in here? All right, okay. You're not alone. I have it too. 50 million people in the U.S. have reported having this sound in their ears. Out of this 50 million people, 35 million people, they don't care. They have habituated. Around 13 million people, they're kind of annoyed by it. And 2 million people are the ones that knock on your door almost every day. What am I going to do with this ringing? So this tinnitus has become a very kind of prevalent condition. So we're going to learn about a little bit about history, a little bit about the auditory system, a little bit about the causes of tinnitus, the neuroscience of tinnitus, what is exactly going on in the brain, because it's a brain phenomenon. And we believe whatever happens in the brain can be solved through the brain also. And we'll learn about the neurophysiological and electrophysiological and neuroimaging of tinnitus, some studies that we have conducted at FAU, and also treatment methods. And I'll try to be fast. Tinnitus is the malady of the 21st century. Why? Because of the amount of noise exposure that we have every day. Every day we are polluted with noise. Medications is also another factor. Medication is one of the underlying reasons for tinnitus. That's why we refer to it as malady of the 21st century. If you notice, there's an icon in here that shows a loudspeaker. I mean, unfortunately, I couldn't play it in here, but when I clicked on it, it would have generated the sound of tinnitus. That would have, you would have experienced what people with tinnitus experience every day, a sound, like a tonal most of the time, relatively loud sounds that they perceive. But we have learned methods and strategies to help patients to habituate to this condition. Tinnitus has become a part of our culture. Edvard Munch, the Norwegian expressionist, drew the picture on your right called Scream. in 1893, and it has become a symbol of tinnitus for many, many cultures and books and references. From a historical point of view, tinnitus has been mentioned in medical texts for hundreds or maybe even thousands of years. It was first coined by Pliny the Elder from the word tinnire in Latin, which means ringing. Then Aristotle mentioned that buzzing in the ears, when you have buzzing in the ears, it ceases when you provide a greater sound around it. So if you ask a lot of your patients, or those who have tinnitus, you don't hear your tinnitus that much when you are in a noisier environment, because it drowns it. And we use those type of approaches and techniques in order to help patients to cope with it. Many scientists, Avicenna, Jean-Marc Gasper from France, they all worked on tinnitus. So for many years and many, many medical textbooks, they refer to it. These famous people had tinnitus. So if you have tinnitus, you may be a famous person too. So people like Beethoven, Van Gogh, and Luther, they had tinnitus. And some scientists believe that if these people didn't have tinnitus, possibly they could contribute more or less, I don't know how we look at it, to the science, to the politics, to the religion, to the art, and all of those. So let's review a little bit of the auditory system. How does the auditory system work? And how we can relate it to tinnitus. Auditory system is a very complicated system. For example, in your visual system, when you see an object, by the time that it reaches to your occipital cortex, it has maybe two stops. From your optic nerve to it crosses through the optic tract, an optic chiasm reaches to your lateral geniculate body in your thalamus and shoots itself to the cortex. So it's just the two stops. In the auditory system, we have almost seven stops. Every single sound that you hear, it stops in several different stations before it reaches to your cortex, before you understand what the signal is. So that's why it makes it a little bit complicated for tinnitus. So as the sounds enter the auditory canal, it moves the tympanic membrane, the ossicular chain, and the introduction of this force right here on my arrow toward the inner ear via the foot plate of Stapes, the smallest bone in the body. And as those signals travel through the cochlea with all of those hair cells, the forces start moving the hair cells. And these hair cells, when they open the channels, when they fire, they send a message to the hearing nerve so we can hear a signal. Any abnormality in this area, in the external ear canal, in the middle ear, or in the inner ear, or the hearing nerve, they all can cause or contribute to tinnitus or its generation. After the signals pass through the cochlea, they enter the auditory nerve. And these auditory nerve fibers transmit those action potentials from the upper level of medulla to your pons, to your midbrain, to your thalamus, medial geniculate body, and they travel to the cortex. So all of those stages that you see, they make one stop or a synapse. So in other words, the auditory system is a very redundant system. That's why that tinnitus persists, because there are multiple areas in the nervous system, especially the central auditory pathway, where the signals actually are getting processed. And when we look at the neuroimaging studies, we can see activity related to tinnitus in the midbrain. We can see activity related to tinnitus in the cortex. We can see activity related to tinnitus on the auditory nerve, because all of these can be generating tinnitus. So what are the causes of tinnitus? Underlying pathophysiology for this. The major reason for tinnitus in the current world is noise exposure. Noise exposure, loud music, hunting, or those type of recreational sounds, they all can cause tinnitus. Aging is another factor. Ototoxicity is another factor. Many medications can cause tinnitus. Genetic factors, metabolic disorders. Many of your patients with diabetes or heart problems or thyroid issues, all of a sudden they report that I have ringing in my ear. Because those type of conditions can also influence the auditory system. And other reasons for tinnitus includes also hearing loss. When you don't hear well, your brain starts to generate sounds. And I'm going to talk about that. So noise exposure, this is a typical audiogram of a person with noise exposure. Noise exposure happens around the frequency of 3 to 8 kilohertz. That's the area of the cochlea that is more vulnerable to the impact of loud sounds. So the basic education that your patient could have is to protect their ears against loud noise. Hearing loss is the most common job-related injury. Hearing loss is the most common condition at birth. Hearing loss is the most common genetic condition. Every genetic book that you open, there's something about hearing loss. So that's why that it becomes more vulnerable. Ototoxic medications. A lot of medications that we give to our patients potentially can be ototoxic. However, studies show that if you're treating a patient for cancer, give them a lot of antioxidants. It can reduce the chance of developing ototoxicity, which I'll talk about. I had a patient who said that my doctor told me to take tonic water, and since then I have started, you know, having tinnitus. And I told him that possibly it's because of the quinine in your tonic water, because that can be an ototoxic agent. So these reports you may hear from your patients. Tinnitus, when it is generated, it can be associated with a lot of other factors, such as stress, anxiety, depression. All of these, whole nine yards of psychological impact, it can be associated with tinnitus. And we need to reduce the secondary effects of tinnitus on the patient's health by doing certain types of management treatment for them. So what is the reason that actually we have tinnitus? Honestly, we don't know yet, but they have some good, you know, answers for it. Tinnitus can be subjective or objective. That means the subjective means that only your patients can hear it. Objective means that not only the patient can hear it, you can hear it also. I have had many patients, when I get close to their ears, I can hear their sound. But most of the times, you have also seen it with your patients, they generate a mechanical sound rather than a tonal sound. One of the red flags of a unilateral tinnitus is acoustic neuroma or vestibular schwannoma. So if a patient comes to us with unilateral tinnitus, after we explore a lot of other conditions, we need to make sure that the patient doesn't have acoustic neuroma. It's a benign tumor. It grows very slowly, but it can influence the person's hearing. It can cause tinnitus, it can cause dizziness and other problems, including facial weakness, because when the tumor is big, it can press on the facial nerve. As you know, the facial nerve, the auditory nerve, the vestibular nerve all pass through the internal auditory canal. So enlargement of this vestibular schwannoma can cause facial problems too, facial weakness. Sometimes tinnitus can be pulsatile. A lot of studies of the carotid arteries, I see a lot of cardiologists in here. So you do a lot of studies on the carotid because patients may have a pulsatile tinnitus. And that can be one of the reasons for the generation of tinnitus, at least for that population. But one of the scientists by the name of Kaltenbach from Wayne State, he has a good theory about tinnitus generation. Basically, his theory refers to the increase in the neural activity in the auditory system. So neurons are firing more than normal, as if you are hearing something. He also mentions that this increased activity causes an increased neural synchrony, But tinnitus is a dyssynchronous signal. And this challenge and interaction between these two causes activation of the different parts of the central auditory system that can contribute to the generation of tinnitus. Some other scientists, such as Salvi from University of Buffalo, they have talked about the neural plasticity or neuroplasticity. On our parietal cortex, we have the sensory homunculus and postcentral gyrus. And all of those areas, they're mapped to different functions for us, as you know. So we believe that if a certain area or part of the body that is represented in postcentral gyrus on the parietal lobe is amputated, for example, other digits, other parts of the body can occupy the region that was responsible for the index finger or thumb, for example. So they can, it's the concept of use it or lose it applies to the brain neuroplasticity. So we believe that in the auditory cortex, that we have the map of different frequencies, we call it a tonotopic organization. We believe that because of the lack of stimulation, especially when the patient has hearing loss, because of the lack of stimulation, the frequencies that the patient can hear well actually occupy or cover the areas of the cortex that were that was responsible for the frequencies that patient doesn't hear well. And that's one of the reasons that patients develop tinnitus, which is related to the hearing loss in most cases. They have done many neuroimaging studies. They have looked at the functional MRIs while the patient was hearing certain sounds, or there are some patients that who can actually generate their tinnitus. And with the use of functional neuroimaging, we can experiment. We can have the patient in normal state, or we can take a picture of fMRI and average it out while the patient is generating their tinnitus. And you may ask, what do I mean by generation or evoking tinnitus? There are some people, around 35 to 40% of tinnitus population, they can make their tinnitus to come and go by the movement of their jaw, or facial muscles, or movement of their eyes, or moving their extremities or digits, they can turn their tinnitus on and off. So by doing that, for example, this is one of the patients, at this moment, he doesn't have tinnitus. As soon as he moves his jaw, his ear starts to ring. That's called an evoked tinnitus. Or this patient, looking straight, there is no tinnitus. Looking to the side, changing their gaze, their ear starts tinnitus. So what this means that if I can take a picture, a functional MRI image of pre and post of having tinnitus or asking the patient to generate their tinnitus, when I subtract these images using statistical procedures, I'll be able to pinpoint which part of the brain is actually generating it. And we call it a tinnitus-related activity. The tinnitus-related activity, as I told you, has been seen in inferior colliculus of the midbrain. It has been seen in medial geniculate body of the thalamus. It has been seen on the auditory cortex. We conducted a few studies in the past 2-3 years, in 2018, we had like 6 papers that was published in peer-reviewed journals about tinnitus. These are some of my colleagues from University of Cambridge and in United Kingdom and Surrey Hospital in Guildford. And what we did, we looked at the connections between parental separation. We looked at different factors. This I'm just mentioning 2 studies in here. We looked at the effects of parental separation in childhood and its impact on tinnitus in adulthood. Also, in another study, we looked at the parental mental health to see what kind of impact it has on the perception of tinnitus and hyperacusis, which is sound sensitivity disorder. And we wanted to see that, are these factors important in the perception and reaction of the patient to tinnitus signal? So they were published, so we looked at those parental separation factor and parental mental health, and we wanted to see if there is a correlation between these two factors. So we had a retrospective study of around 287 subjects, and we looked at the parental mental health and other factors. We used certain types of tools that a lot of psychologists and psychiatrists will use, such as GAD-7 for anxiety. We looked at tinnitus questionnaires and hyperacusis questionnaires. And what we found that the parental separation in childhood did not have a significant effect on the perception of tinnitus in adulthood. However, parental mental health was extremely important in the perception of tinnitus and hyperacusis as an adult. So those subjects who had a history of parental mental health, such as depression and anxiety, they had more, the tinnitus had more impact on their life compared to those who did not mention mental health. I reported this research last year in Taiwan, and there were a few psychologists and psychiatrists were in the audience, and they said that they're going to start exploring parental mental health when they see tinnitus patients. So I highly recommend doing that also in here. This is a flow chart from tinnitus research initiative. There's a group in Regensburg, Germany that we have worked with them. We have published with them also. And they put this up to guide clinicians how to analyze and how to look at every tinnitus patient. It's an interesting chart. So it talks about the mechanical tinnitus, which is the pulsatile tinnitus on your right, at different procedures that needs to be done, if it's like a need for neurovascular examination, echo Doppler angiography, all of those mechanical conditions that can cause pulsatile tinnitus. And then non-pulsatile tinnitus. These are people that who have a continuous sound in their ears. Is it associated with vertigo? Is it associated with headaches? Are there any psychiatric issues? So all of these are here basically giving examples of step-by-step follow-up of these subjects. However, what I want to tell you, the message that I have today for you is on this side. It says counseling, all the way from the top to the bottom. A lot of these patients develop a fear, a huge level of anxiety over this. And that causes a significant problem. So it's important to guide the patient, give them hope, give them proper advice in order to help them to cope with this annoying sound that they hear 24/7 in their ears. Many of you, like I see some of my colleagues who are in treatment of cancer patients. This is a very, very common finding in patients to develop tinnitus following the use of ototoxic medications. So, this is the thing that patients ask from you. Turn this off for me. Where is the magic pill? The first thing I tell my patients, I don't have a magic pill. I don't have a quick fix, but I can help you. Within a few months, you'll be able to manage it, you'll be able to cope with it. So does anyone know who this guy is? On your left, the Quasimodo, right? Why he has tinnitus? Because of the bell, exactly. The noise exposure that this poor guy has had for 50 years caused his tinnitus. Unfortunately, these are some of the comments that people have heard. Go on, live with it. We did a survey almost 20 years ago. Go on, live with it. Nothing can be done. If I know how to cure you, I'll be a rich person. It is in your head. It's not in their head. It is real. I had a patient. I didn't put it in here. He was told that people like you, it was like 10, 15 years ago, he was told that people like you usually kill themselves. And that wasn't a good thing. So tragedies has happened. So that's why the title said, why never should not say no to your patients. Tragedies has happened. Two physicians were actually harmed by not counseling the patients well. I can tell you that way. In 1992, a prominent physician in Michigan and another physician in 2008. So we need to be very careful how we approach this. Yes, it's a very difficult situation. It's hard to manage. If you open very, very old medical texts, one of the conditions that is hard to manage is tinnitus. Go read your history of your medicine. You will see that. It has been around with us for thousands of years. We haven't been able to find a magic pill for it, but it's a very, very manageable condition. And it starts with you guys. It starts with you as the gatekeepers of our health. When the patients come to you with tinnitus, it's a manageable condition. It is doable to help the patients to cope with this condition. So, and we have a variety of methods. We have used applied medications, cognitive behavioral therapy, sound therapy, electrical stimulation. Some people have had surgical treatments or certain conditions can be treated with surgery. Amplification, biofeedback, cochlear implants. There are people who are deaf, profoundly deaf. And they have tinnitus. How can you treat those people? We know that cochlear implant and implantation of those electrical pulses in the cochlear and auditory neurons can suppress tinnitus. Electrical stimulation. I think that in the future, we're going to be able to do this. We have this electrical stimulation procedures and methods that the same way that our neurosurgeons and neuroscientists are using the DBS, deep brain stimulation for Parkinson, by zapping that portion of the brain for, is that the nucleus is for the Parkinson? Substantia nigra, thank you. The substantia nigra. So maybe we can one day have the method of direct electrical stimulation of certain parts of the auditory system that can zap tinnitus. But because, as I showed you, there are multiple areas that can contribute to the generation of tinnitus, it can be a little bit difficult. But the studies have been done. This is the series of microelectrodes. You can see in here, there are 16 microwires, basically, they're stimulating the auditory cortex in the mouse. Auditory cortex, as you know, is a deep in the lateral fissure. There are Heschel's gyri that the stimulation is being conducted over there, and they have been able to see reduction of tinnitus in mice. Then you may say, how do they know the mice have tinnitus? We have scientists that poor graduate students, their job is to count the number of times that a mouse will lick water. So we provide them with a small tank that has water. And when the mice is, they count the number of times that the mice is licking the water. And then they generate a noise and they count it. A loud noise, and they generate the tinnitus for the laboratory species by loud noise or toxic medication, now the mice has or have tinnitus. So by counting the number of times the mouse is licking that water bottle or water tank, we can compare if there is tinnitus or no tinnitus. So they have seen reduction in the behavioral response of the mice. Some studies came out with the stimulation of the vagus nerve. Vagus nerve, as you know, sends a branch to your auditory canals called Arnold's nerve. I always teach my students, remember the governor of California, former governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger. And that's, as you know, that's like if you're cleaning an ear or something, patient starts to cough, that's your Arnold reflex, so you need to be very careful. So what they have done, they have stimulated the vagus nerve from the neck combined with auditory signal, and they have been able to, with the use of neuroplasticity techniques or approaches or theories, have been able to suppress tinnitus. RTMS, the repeated transcranial magnetic stimulation, has been shown to be effective for some patients. We use RTMS, my psychiatrist colleagues, they use it for depression, anxiety. In Europe, they have found around 20-30% success of using RTMS to manage tinnitus. One of our colleagues, Dr. Susan Shore in Ann Arbor, Michigan, she has a study on activation of the nuclei of the central auditory pathway, especially the dorsal cochlear nucleus, which is at the border of medulla and pons, and they have been able to suppress tinnitus in some species, and they're hoping to apply it for a human. Neuromod, this came out from Ireland, and again, it uses electrical stimulation of the tongue combined with auditory signal, and they report success for it. Medication therapy has been also offered for tinnitus. Unfortunately, again, as I told you, we do not have a magic pill, but who knows, sometimes some patients may get better with certain types of medications. And one of my colleagues in the University of Iowa, he did a study. He had groups of people who were answering questions that if you spend, like, let's say, money for your treatment, which one would you use? Medications, surgery, devices, multiple sessions of counseling and other things. Guess which one had the highest acceptability among the patients? Pills. It's much easier for a lot of patients. Rather than I have to drive to my therapist every week, once a week, I can take a pill at my home. So let me fix it that way. So people want this magic pill. Hopefully one of you guys can find it one day. I'll be your number one fan. But the thing is, till that time comes, we need to use other approaches to help these patients. So, the Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery Association came up with this clinical practice guidelines. They studied or looked at hundreds of evidence-based studies to see which one of these approaches actually can help. Unfortunately, they rejected or recommended against pharmaceutical medications, dietary supplements, transcranial magnetic stimulation. They couldn't find any evidence that these medications or approaches could actually help the patients. So if you do a simple search online, you will see hundreds of different types of supplements have been offered to treat tinnitus. It's a huge business. And unfortunately, we don't have a good outcome from these. I mean, yes, I give sometimes supplements for the patients. but I know that possibly it is just, may have a placebo effect. But some studies have recommended using of NAC, the N-acetylcysteine, for tinnitus because of its significant antioxidant capabilities. So it may be an option for some people. Or people with a lot of muscle issues, tiredness. So Flexeril can help in some cases because it actually activates the locus coeruleus, which is responsible for stress and panic. So if I can reduce the stress and panic, potentially it can help with the tinnitus also. The whole world is looking at CBD, this thing that is going to solve all of our problems. And we don't know. I mean, we don't have any studies that supports it. Some people use it. They have a better sleep, maybe. It may reduce the consequences of tinnitus, which insomnia is one of them. One of the most evidence-based managements for tinnitus is called CBT, or cognitive behavioral therapy. And it has been used not only for tinnitus, it's been used for pain, headaches, and all of those conditions. It's a psychological intervention that aims to alleviate anxiety by helping the patient to modify their dysfunctional cognitions, ruminations, and safety-seeking behaviors. Why this is important, especially the word ruminations. Ruminations means that as a patient, I'm seeking methods to justify this problem that I have without actually looking for a solution for it. In other words, I'm looking for a distressful situation by reminding myself of this bad condition that I have without even looking for a solution for it. And cognitive behavioral therapy has been used to reduce our emotional reaction to tinnitus. A lot of your patients with tinnitus, when they come to you, they have anxiety, they have stress, they have fatigue, they have other conditions, the psychological conditions associated with it. And it becomes extremely important to guide them through the right path. This is the model that my colleague and I presented about how to counsel and how to manage these conditions. The initial emotion that the patient shows is their trigger is their tinnitus. So they put negative thoughts in their head. I don't like my tinnitus. These are thoughts that they have. It interrupts everything I do. It affects my relationships, my family, my job. It's a big monster. It is taking away my silence. There is no peace. These are the negative thoughts the patient is putting in their head. And this negative thoughts that we call them NATs, negative automatic thoughts, results in some sort of emotions. They become upset, they become frightened, hopeless, annoyed, angry, sad. You can ask from any of your tinnitus patients, the ones that are impacted with it. They will show you these type of symptoms. Then they will develop some physical sensations. Tinnitus cannot cause pain. Tinnitus is not a pain signal. But it results in physical sensations. I have pain in my ear. I have my shoulders ache. My muscles ache. So they are tense in shoulders, their hands. They are fearful. They are restless. And then this vicious cycle develops into more evaluative thoughts. Because the patient could not address their primary thoughts, that it's not real, that I'm not going to lose my job. I'm not going to lose my relationships. It becomes more evaluative thoughts because they have not fixed the negative automatic thoughts that they had. I will not be able to make it. I will be isolated. I'm not normal. So this psychological vicious circle, unfortunately, exacerbates the tinnitus condition. I have had many patients that, Ali, I'm going to lose my job. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to function. I'm not going to be able to continue my studies and those type of things. So counseling the patient becomes extremely important. Hearing loss and tinnitus are extremely related. Because if you do not hear well, the first thing that you're going to hear is your own tinnitus. So it becomes extremely important. Listening hard, straining to hear becomes an important issue. And we have been able to help a lot of tinnitus patients by providing amplification for them. We have given them hearing aids that has helped them to reduce their anxiety associated with tinnitus. So if a patient can hear, their tinnitus can be mixed with other sounds, and it can help them not to perceive their tinnitus. So improving untreated hearing loss not only has impact on tinnitus, it has been introduced to study to show reducing the depression, improving the lifespan, reducing the cognitive decline by 30 to 40%. It can impact the balance and it can reduce dementia. Just by improving hearing. These are studies that came out from famous scientific labs. And we know that when a patient has hearing loss, improving their hearing actually helps with their tinnitus. So we have used sound therapy, habituation therapy, to help the patient to habituate to this signal. All of us are hearing different sounds. I mean, if you listen carefully, you can hear the projector, you can hear possibly the air conditioner. We don't pay attention to those because we have habituated to it. My job is to train the patient to habituate to these signals. When they habituate to the signal, it won't be annoying to them. So habituation, we define as the disappearance of a reaction to a stimulus. You buy a new refrigerator, you go to home, you hear the refrigerator. Oh, it makes noise. I'm going to change it. 2 days later, you don't hear it because you have habituated to it. So the goals of habituation and habituation therapy, it's the process in which tinnitus becomes an unimportant signal, even though it is still there. Our body makes a lot of noise. You hear your own breathing. You hear your heartbeat sometimes. We don't pay attention to them because we have habituated to them. So the goal for tinnitus therapy at this moment of time and science that we have is to help the patient to habituate to it. And many, many patients, when they habituate to it, it doesn't interfere with their life anymore. And they will be able to manage and go back to normal life. So with habituation, according to Jastreboff, the patient will habituate to tinnitus itself. That means that the signal is there, but they're not perceiving it. And the patient should habituate to the emotional consequences of the tinnitus. Tinnitus has a lot of emotional consequences. Sleeping problems, distress, anxiety, fatigue, pain, all of those can be associated with tinnitus, and habituation tries to solve it. This is my take-home message. There are many, many methods which can help tinnitus patients. Incorporating a healthy and informative approach for tinnitus patients in your practice is essential. But when the patient comes to you, you may not believe it, but I have had patients that said that when the doctor came to the office to see me, as soon as he saw tinnitus, he said, no, we can't do anything for you. See you later. That impact on the tinnitus was so strong on the patient that the patient developed a more severe tinnitus than my doctor, the person with authority, told me that they can't do anything for me. So counseling the patient is very important. Giving them hope is important. And believe me, according to the studies, more than 90% of the tinnitus cases are manageable. And it starts with you. When you see your patients, it starts with you. When you give them hope, they know that there is something that they can do. Like any other thing, you give hope to many other conditions. You don't send them home. You give them hope. You have a headache, I'm going to help you. You have a backache, I'm going to help you. You have cancer, I'm going to help you. Give them hope. Tinnitus, again, same thing. It is extremely manageable. I usually want to be always on time, so I'm going to give a few minutes for questions. And after that, I wish you luck for everything that you do, and thank you very much. Yes, sir.
What types of conditions can cause tinnitus that the physician can hear? If I understood you correctly.
Yes. Good question. So that's called objective tinnitus. Two or three common ones is called myoclonus of the stapedius muscle. So the muscle contracts and you will hear it. It's like a clicking sound. Sometimes you can also hear the turbulent vascular response. It's like under carotid. The actual sound comes out. You can hear it. It's called objective. But a lot of times either it's the palatal muscle contraction or the stapedius muscle contraction or some sort of vascular turbulence that you can hear. In the past, maybe around 35 years that I'm seeing tinnitus patients, I would say I have had maybe one or two cases that I heard a tone was coming out from the ear. It's very, very rare. Actually, in 1980s, there was a scientist who put a microphone in the ear. He was an astrophysicist. Put a microphone in the ear, and they recorded sounds from the ear without any stimulus. They said, oh my God, we found tinnitus. Because they put a sensitive microphone. Then they realized that only we have spontaneous activity. Our ears generate sounds. It comes out all the time. It's like a microphone works. If you listen to a microphone, there's a sound coming out from it. Our ears always generate activity. It's called spontaneous autoacoustic emissions. But only in 4% of the population, the sound of the tinnitus and autoacoustic emissions are the same frequencies. So, yes, it's possible to have spontaneous activity come out. Yes, sir?
Just a comment that you were stating all the stress and all that stuff, the anxiety and all that. I think it's not only the patient, but the environment where the patient is, and that is the family, the spouse, and all that. If they don't understand it, it just keep getting worse and worse.
That's excellent point. Sometimes I always ask patients to come with their spouses. And sometimes spouse, wife, or husband say, I don't know why he's complaining about or she's complaining. There's nothing. So you hear a noise. I say, excuse me, give me a minute. I put them in our acoustic booth. I put them, sit here for 2 minutes. Then I generate a tone with my device. I said, I'll come back in a minute. And then I come back after a minute. I say, so how was it? I said, well, fine, but what was that noise? Your machine was making beep sound. I said, well, that's the thing that your poor husband or wife or son or friend is hearing 24/7. Oh, my God, it's really bad. So at that point becomes, so the counseling part, explain to your patient that this is a real condition. It can, there are people with tinnitus that are in disability. VA spends $1 billion a year for compensation to the soldiers. $1 billion. Only 1% of that money goes to research, which is around $10 million a year. So we give $1 billion as compensation to our veterans, only spend 1% of that for tinnitus research. Yes, sir.
Does internal sound devices create more tinnitus than external noise? There's a lot of internal devices in airplanes for watching movies, and
yes, when they are at a louder level, it can damage the hair cells. That's a very good point. Like using iPods and earphones. At a high level, it can damage the hair cells. And unfortunately, the hair cells in the auditory system, they are not recoverable. In other words, when you damage the cells, they don't come back. Mammals, we cannot regenerate hair cells. Bird, fish, and shark, they can make the cells come back. But mammals, we cannot do it. So what happens is when you damage the ear, when you kill the cells with the loud sounds, it's not recoverable. And that's one of the reasons for tinnitus, the noise exposure that I mentioned. However, we use devices, controlled level devices, to help the patients to manage their tinnitus. And that's a different type of controlled condition that we use. But yes, loud noise can damage the inner ear hair cells. Yes? Excellent, yes. It seems that what they don't generate tinnitus, but they can exacerbate it. For example, too much alcohol, too much salt, it can make it worse. Some patients, maybe spicy food can cause it, can trigger it more. But they are not the reason that generate tinnitus. They can make the condition worse. Good question. Yes. Excellent question. Tinnitus is any external sound, is defined as any external sound without any tinnitus is a sound without any external source. So it can be ringing, it can be humming, it can be whooshing, it can be static noise. As long as no one talks to our ears, we are fine. If you hear voices, that's a different condition. But there are people who hear their music. We call it musical tinnitus. There are people who hear sounds played in their head. It's like when you hear a song that it stays in your head, we call it an earworm. That's that there's an expression called earworm. So you hear a song, it's keep playing in your head. That's a different thing. But if you hear music in your head, it's not a real auditory hallucination. We know that there are certain parts of the temporal lobe are being activated, that you hear an old song. I had a patient who said that I hear auctions in my ear all the time. And I told her that as long as you don't buy anything from them, you'll be fine. So yes, we have sometimes an auditory memory keeps playing in our head. And that is not a psychiatric condition. If someone talks to you, you hear someone, okay, Ali, go and do this and go and do that. I'm talking to you. It's more schizophrenia and psychiatric situation. But if you hear continuous music, that's musical tinnitus. And people have had that. And I have had cases that I have been able to help them. Yes, sir.
Can you amplify on the discussion about devices used to mask the tinnitus?
Excellent. Yes. When we do tinnitus evaluation, we figure out what frequency range it has. Then we target that frequency region with certain stimuli that can suppress it. We have a phenomenon called residual inhibition. I had a patient I reported in France a few years ago that this patient had a tonal tinnitus, and with 1 minute of stimulation, it was suppressed for 2 months. So finding the right frequency, finding the right stimulus is important. And yes, the devices can generate soothing signals for the patient that can be mixed with their tinnitus. It will help them not to perceive their tinnitus that much. And hearing aids is another factor. People who have hearing loss, if you compensate for the region that they don't hear well, it will help them to manage their tinnitus much, much better. But all of these need to be combined with counseling. You cannot just give a device and send the patient home. You need to provide them counseling and support. And after a few months, around 80 to 90% of at least my patients, I have seen that they have huge improvement. Yes, sir.
Use of aspirin, Tylenol, and ibuprofen to cause tinnitus.
Excellent point. Aspirin in high doses can cause tinnitus and hearing loss. For some reason, aspirin effects are temporary. So when your patient stops it, tinnitus recovers. I do not know what's the reason for it. High doses of any medications can cause it. I didn't want to mention those medications, but such as like a lot of ototoxic medications can cause tinnitus and hearing loss. But using, there's a study came out from Toronto recently for children who are going under cancer therapy with cisplatinum and carboplatinum, giving a good amount of antioxidants to them reduced the percentage of tinnitus and hearing loss significantly. And sometimes you can ask your otology colleagues to inject actually these agents into the inner ear via the round window so it can reduce the chance of ototoxicity of these medications. We have evidence for that now. Yes. That's an excellent point. Actually, in our textbooks and articles, we always compare the pathways of tinnitus and pain together. The same way this approach for the pain management is applied for the tinnitus also. So counseling and reducing the symptomatic treatment, basically. And then habituation. Excellent. Thank you. Well, thank you for giving this time to me. I really appreciate it.